Chapter 4. The Ash Wastes. Polixis. Polixis and Squad Domitian linked up with a trio of Zoyshen Lehman Russ battle tanks, about half a mile west of Shibat's outskirts. The Zoyshen commander, a captain named Chao Li, had already lost half of his armored company, fighting scattered rearguard actions along the banks of the Gorgon, as greenskin barges and rafts had poured across the sluggish, toxic river. The remaining tanks were accompanied by little more than a single ragged platoon of Voitican infantry, who stared at the Primaris as they emerged from the night, caked in dust and congealed alien blood. "Is there anything left further south of here?" Domitian asked Chao Li, whilst the battered column paused amidst the remains of what had once been the city's main maglev line, now broken and twisted beneath the mass of debris thrown down by the rock's impact. "We're the last," Chao Li said from the cupola of his Lehman Russ Punisher. "I had a demolisher half a mile southeast of us, but I've not heard anything over the Vox for 20 minutes. If he's not already out, he won't be getting out."
"Keep moving," Domitian said.
The Hellblasters falling in either side of the tanks as they began to trundle along the maglev line's remains. Severus and his pack of Reavers had already dropped away, disappearing with as little notice as they had first appeared, presumably moving to help extricate another squad from close contact with the Xenos still pouring across the river. Polixis checked the dispersal runes on his visor. Nearly all of the Demi-Company had progressed east and were nearing Shebat's edge. All except Captain Demeter, his aggressors, and the repulsor Extremis. They remained to the south, utterly surrounded now by icons representing enemy contacts. Every instinct demanded Polixis turn and go to the aid of his captain and brothers. To lose the captain, the company standard, and the likes of Extremis was a dire blow for the Fulminata, but to also lose all of their progenoids as well was almost unconscionable. He tried to focus his mind on the matters that defined him: duty, the willingness to serve and save. He had to follow orders. He had to follow the Codex.
"Without the seed of our warriors, the chapter dies," he reminded himself, voicing one of his apothecary pledges. "But without me, few can extract it. I will put my own duty above all else."
To have stayed at Demeter's side or gone back to him once he was engulfed would have been an outrageous dereliction of his own duties, and a break with numerous salient tenets of the Codex Astartes. Worst of all, it would have rendered the captain's sacrifice in vain. He would not go back. He busied himself with reviewing his charges as he trudged alongside the Zoyshen tanks. According to their readouts, both Trejo and Ennio were suffering, but their vitae had stabilized and the chances of a fatality had now reduced to almost nil. Trejo would have joined Brother Priscor aboard the Spear of Macrag for bionic refit and an intensive period of bonding therapy, but the Xenos fleet now controlling orbital space had denied such a possibility. The crippled Primaris would have no choice other than to remain with the rear echelons once they were eventually re-established. Ennio at least would still be capable of fighting once the crushed remains of his left forearm were amputated. Gilliman knew it looked like the Fulminata would need every Primaris still capable of lifting a bolter soon enough. Eventually, they broke free of Shebat's eastern flank and passed the slums that had been flattened by the rock's blast wave. Dawn light was attempting to break through the pall of dust and ash kicked up by the impact, creating a dull grey tinge that the auto-sensors of the Primaris picked up and amplified. Polixis mounted a final mound of masonry on Shebat's edge as the armour and their weary support squads trudged past, the passage of the tanks making the rubble underfoot vibrate. The apothecary looked east, to where the ash wastes spread out beyond the refinery city, undulating dunes and barren tundra whipped by an eye-stinging, throat-parching wind. The many miles between Shebat and the great, brutalist sprawl of the capital city of Croton would have appeared truly desolate, were it not for the thousands of figures now making their weary way out into the expanse. Polixis watched as the Imperium withdrew from Shebat. The miserable grey light picked out dozens of columns, insubstantial, faceless masses in the half-darkness, winding away from the city's edge. Armored vehicles, tanks, and cargo eights, interspersed lines of bent-backed, respirator-clad infantry, moving with the weary tread of those who had just come within inches of a violent death. Company and regimental pennants fluttered in the caustic wind, their ash-caked fabric acting as rallying points for the scattered units that had dragged themselves from the ruined city after command and control had broken down. Less than half a mile away, Polixus's enhanced eyesight picked out the struggles of a labouring Adeptus Mechanicus engine seer and his dead-fleshed servitors as they fought to repair a Lehman Russ that had broken down just off one of the Rock Creek roads leading from the city. Nearby, a Departmento Munitorum flatbed was dispensing water canisters, the quartermaster standing on the back of the trailer, bellowing furiously for order at the mob of parched guardsmen that had surrounded the vehicle. The entire expanse before the Primaris was a disorganized, demoralized vista, the personification of defeat. Domitian clambered up onto the runners of Chow Lee's battle tank, the vehicle pausing before it rolled out into the ash wastes. They were consulting the guard officer's pocket chart. Polixus descended from his mound of rubble and rejoined the squad. Trajo had been mounted on the rear of one of the Zoishen tanks, and Polixus applied another salve shot to him via his armor's interface port. The Hellblaster was silent, his mood grim. It looked as though bionics were going to be the only feasible treatment.
"Soon you'll contain so much metal that Helix won't be able to operate on you any more," Gratian joked gruffly, looking up at his fellow Hellblaster. "Techmarine Tiberon will be the one to oil you. At least it won't be difficult for me to kick you to death when you make more ill jests, brother," Trajo replied from between gritted teeth. Despite himself, Polixus smiled. "Fifth and Eighth Corps have established a cordon 3 miles further east," Domitian voxed as he dropped back down from the Lehman Russ. "Along a ridgeline past the waste dunes. The tanks will continue following the maglev. There's still no contact with Lieutenant Tyrannus, so we'll do the same and link with the new front once we reach it." They moved on, joining the rear of a straggling column of Numerians already using the maglev line to move out into the grey expanse beyond the city. Even behind the glassy film of their respirator lenses, Polixus could recognize the looks they gave the towering ultramarines, fear coupled with shame and raw exhaustion. It was easy to forget that even the most experienced soldiers of the Astra Militarum lacked the fortitude of the Adeptus Astartes. In the past 12 hours, these men had successfully driven the Xenos menace from half of Shebat and achieved all their objectives, only for the sky itself to come crashing down on them. Comrades had been crushed and buried alive in their thousands, and an enemy they had thought beaten, at least for one day, had come surging at them once again with renewed ferocity. Now they were retreating, abandoning wounded friends and the streets they had fought and bled for, all reduced to rubble. These men were beaten. They could be rallied, though. Polixus knew that much. He had seen his brother do it enough times to be in no doubt about the resilience of mankind's fighting spirit. He just hoped it could be done before the Greenskins followed up on their victory. The vox clicked, a few words cutting through before the link degenerated into static again. Contact with the rest of the Fulminata had been almost wholly lost, and most of the squads were only appearing occasionally now on the map interface. There was no sign whatsoever of Demeter or the Battle Brothers who had made their stand to the south. Polixus forced their fate from his mind. There was nothing that could be done now. They had to reach the newly established line out in the wastes, then ensure it was capable of receiving the next Greenskin attack when it inevitably came. As the column trudged on, the apothecary glanced back towards Shebat. The ruination that had descended on the city was only just becoming apparent as the day's light spread and the worst of the dust cloud began to settle. A moonscape of craggy stone, rockcrete and broken girders stretched away, as desolate and bleak as the ash dunes ahead. In the distance, the Primaris thought he could pick out the defiant spires of the Basilica, still standing tall amidst the destruction.
He wondered whether the orcs had reached it yet. Polixis did not put a great deal of stock in battle oaths and pledges of vengeance. He had more vital duties to attend to than matters of personal honour. But in that moment, surrounded by defeat, he swore that he would return and reclaim those distant spires for the Primarch and the Emperor and all those who had fallen in their defence. Today had been a bloody reckoning. There would be another soon. Castor. The nexus of the new Imperial defensive line east of Shebat Alpha was a long, low ash dune labelled Ridge 1. It had only just acquired the moniker, courtesy of some Departamento cartographic analyst attached to the 8th Corps. Whether the primitive ash waste dwellers had a name for the rise running between the Maglev line and the main highway to Croton, nobody seemed to know. On the Fulminata's strategic displays, it remained a nameless, largely featureless stretch of barren grey soil. By the time Castor reached it, defensive preparations were well underway. Two batteries of Vostroyan mobile artillery from the 8th Corps had been sighted just back from the ridgeline. Basilisks and manticores mostly, interspersed with Hydra anti-aircraft guns. Initially, the guard had attempted to establish trenches along the ridge's length, before quickly realizing that the shifting ash soil would make the task impossible. Instead, sandbags had been filled, and raised redoubts were taking shape, interspersed with battle tanks acting as makeshift strongpoints. The air was filled with the thud and scrape of shovels and the growl of engines as the Ultramarine's chaplain climbed the slope to where the Corps commander's skull pennant was fluttering in the bitter morning breeze. Lieutenant Tyrannus was at Castor's side. The Fulminata's second-in-command had assumed leadership of the Demi-Company since contact had been lost with Demeter. He had spoken little to Castor since the chaplain had linked up with him just east of the Basilica. He could sense the lieutenant's thoughts were the same as his. Both seethed over the defeat they had suffered. Multiple times during the withdrawal from Shebat, it was all Castor could do not to turn on his heel and stride after Captain Demeter. Each time, he had reminded himself that the role of the chaplain was not only one of fiery vengeance. He was a guide, an exemplar for all his brethren, and to be seen to abandon reason and go against direct orders in the name of zealous fervour was a sin against the Codex that he refused to commit. They climbed Ridge 1. All the Fulminata squads had reached Imperial lines, though most had done so further north. It would take time to gather them all once more. Ahead of Castor, amid a sandbag redoubt being slowly assembled by labouring ash-caked Kelistan stormers, lay the forward command post of Major General Chevik. It was a prefabricated envirodome, reinforced by flakboard and sandbags, and studded with Vox uplink masts. The respirator mast Tempest Scions, standing guard at the main entrance, didn't try to stop the two Ultramarines as they ducked inside. Within, they discovered a cramped space housing little more than a camp desk littered with charts and data slates, and a bulky Vox system, wired up to a wall formed at the rear of the dome by a row of Departamento-stamped flakboards. General Chevik himself was standing to one side, an aide helping him out of his heavy, brocaded red uniform, while another vainly tried to dust the cloying grey ash from the thick fur of his tall papaka hat. The commander of the 8th Corps was a short, bluff figure, typical of the guard regiments of Vostroya. His heavy grey moustache was impeccably waxed and curled, and a jagged scar running down the left side of his face caused one eyelid to droop lower than the other. The aides continued to try dusting ash from the fine lace and furred collar of the general's uniform, while Chevik, now in his shirt sleeves and boots, made the sign of the Aquila towards the two Primaris. "My lords," he said, flinty eyes taking in the towering armoured warriors without any hint of trepidation.
"Welcome to 8th Corps Command. How can I be of service?"
"Our thanks, Major General," Tyrannus said, mirroring the guardsman's salute.
"We have come here directly from Shebat. We no longer have contact with Captain Demeter, so I have assumed leadership of the Fulminata for the time being."
"Then my men and I are at your disposal, Lord," Chevik said, inclining his head slightly.
"You have received word from Field Marshal Kloss?"
Not since I was ordered to establish a new defensive line here. From what I can gather, the Field Marshal is with 5th Corps, 6 miles to the north.
Show me your dispositions, Tyrannus ordered, moving to the chart-littered camp table. Castell remained near the post's self-sealing entrance flap as the lieutenant discussed the strength and location of Chevik's 16 divisions. In truth, the chaplain's mind was elsewhere. Severus had reported back to him in person. His brother lived. He had already given silent thanks for such a blessing. To have lost the captain and ancient alongside the Repulsor and the Fulminatus standard was a grievous blow. To have also lost the Strike Force's only apothecary would have spelled disaster. Castor did not feel the need to further rationalize his orders to the Reavers. Polixis would no doubt be angry with him. If there was one particular fault they both shared, it was the fact that neither found it easy admitting when they needed help, least of all from the other. It had been the same ever since they were children. Not that Polixis remembered much of their lives pre-induction. The privilege of being haunted by those memories seemed to have been reserved for Castor only. He watched as Tyrannus listened to Chevik's reports about the situation of the new front. The lieutenant had maglocked his helm, and his expression was open and engaged. Like Demeter, interacting with others seemed to come naturally to him. He had consciously moulded himself in the captain's image, striving to achieve the ideals of the Codex, a rounded warrior strategist, with an eye for the diplomacy required whenever the disparate wings of the Imperium's armed forces fought side by side. Objectively, the Fulminata couldn't have found itself with a better commander. That didn't ease their loss, though.
"We're still receiving columns from Shebat," Chevik was saying, indicating 3 points along the ridgeline displayed on one of the maps. "Mostly elements of the 1st and 3rd Corps. Organization is minimal. We're admitting them through our lines here, here, and here. The rear echelons have been opened up, and they're being regrouped. Major General Hunley is still in command of the 3rd. 1st is under the acting command of Commissar General Vrenk."
"Are both corps still combat capable?" Tyrannus asked.
"You are with them, my lord. You probably know better than I do. The collapse of so much of the city and the chaos of the retreat has left some units at less than 50% of their starting strength. How many of those reported missing will straggle in over the next few days is impossible to say. There seem to be a great deal of walking wounded, too. Again, courtesy of the city's collapse. My corps aid stations are already overburdened, and we're working to establish better triage all across the line."
"If the Greenskins mount a concerted attack across the line within the next few hours, we will not be able to resist them," Tyrannus said, simply. It looked as though Chevik was going to argue, his Vostroyan pride stung. Eventually, though, he nodded.
"I cannot deny that. Not only would the line collapse, but any breach would likely see the whole front overrun. I doubt those units still regrouping to our rear would hold for long. We are not ready."
"Then it is my duty to make you ready," Tyrannus said. He turned towards Custer.
"I will need a transport," the chaplain said, before the lieutenant had spoken. "You may have my personal command, Chimera," Chevik said. "Its Vox system should help you coordinate more closely with the commanders on the ground."
"I will dispatch Sergeants Clastis and Nerva to the corps immediately north and south of us," Tyrannus added. "With the Emperor's blessings, we will be ready by nightfall."
"May his light go with you, Brother Lieutenant," Custer said. "And with you, General Chevik. I will return as soon as I am able."
He made the sign of the Aquila and pushed out through the Envirodome's flap. Outside, the wind was rising, whipping up an ash cloud to further clog an atmosphere already choked with the dust of the rock's fallout. Though midday was fast approaching, the world seemed locked in a perpetual twilight, the figures labouring at the sandbag redoubts below Castor reduced to indistinct, bent-over spectres in the grey gloom. Though he'd been outside for mere seconds, already ash was starting to heap around his boots and cake his vestments. There was a sudden supersonic bang reverberating like a thunderclap across the ridgeline. Custer looked skywards, but even his skull-helm's lenses were unable to pick out whatever had passed overhead through the dust storm. It seemed hard to believe that any aircraft could be aloft in such conditions, but nor did he find the idea of green-skinned pilots braving the choked atmosphere hard to believe. Once the worst of the ash settled, the Ork's crewed air fleet would surely descend on the Imperial positions en masse. As long as the aliens controlled orbit, they controlled the skies. Instinct told Custer that the fighting in Shabbat had only been a prelude, that there was more slaughter to come. He hoped he was right. The Xenos scum were crying out for vengeance, and he would deliver it. Stabscar. The commandos were the first greenskins to reach the Humi shrine place. Under Stabscar's directives, they approached cautiously, using the flanks of the square laid out before the looming structure. There was no movement from up ahead. The ruins stretched away in the grey half-light, and the Humi corpses and wrecks that littered the square remained motionless. Stabscar signalled for the point boys to move in through the great building's front doors, peering after them as they disappeared into the darkness beyond. His gut told him the Humis were long gone. He'd never heard of them abandoning big, fancy, spiky buildings like the one in front of him without a fight, unless they decided to leg it. He hadn't reached his current rank, however, by taking unnecessary risks. That was what the footsloggers were for. After a few tense moments, one of the commandos re-emerged on the building's entrance steps and waved the thumb and little finger of one hand above his head. All clear.
"Move, gits,"
Stabscar grunted at the rest of the mob, iron-shod boots cracking off the stone steps as they hustled up and into the great building. Beyond the doors, the commando boss found himself in an echoing, vaulted space that rose on thick stone pillars and swooped overhead in a series of vast arches. He had seen such structures on several previous occasions. They always made for good looting. He'd never understood why the Humis spent such time and effort building them, much less why they then packed such wastes of space with all sorts of shiny gubbins. But what mattered most of all was that they usually gave a good scrap trying to defend them.
"Where's all the Humis, then?"
one of the commandos, Grit, demanded sullenly. Stabscar didn't deign to answer, but it was a struggle not to show his own disappointment. Taking one of these buildings without a fight felt wrong. Zorg, the commando boss, snapped at the smallest, runtiest greenskin in the mob.
"Get moving and find a war boss. Tell him the Humis is definitely gone and we've got their big spiky place."
As Zorg scampered off, Stabscar drew his ragged camo cape around him and sat heavily on one of the carved wooden benches occupying the building's open floor, the timber groaning beneath his weight. If nothing else, he hoped taking the vast structure would make Urgork forget about the fact that his commandos had failed to find the Beaky in the white armour. Polixis. The Voitican on the operating table was unconscious again. Polixis watched the orderlies working over him, marvelling at their struggles. To see the difficulty human medicates had in keeping their patients stable always led Polixis to reflect on the blessings of Adeptus Astartes' physiology. Here, men screamed. They lost control of their bowels. They flatlined. They bled out, and the apothecary had been forced to remind himself that a normal mortal's wounds didn't clot within seconds of their own accord. Men looked to their battlefield exploits to claim that space marines were a long step removed from humanity, demigods of war, but the differences were even more apparent here, beneath the harsh surgery lumens, amidst the blood and the sweat and the screaming and the thump of bone saws and slitting of scalpels. He dragged himself from his thoughts and turned away from the operation he'd been watching, heading instead for the Medicaid dome's entrance. The large space was packed with the wounded and the dying, and stank of counterseptics and blood. Most of the injuries were fractures, breaks and crush wounds, all related to the sudden collapse of so much of Shebat's infrastructure when the rock had struck. Many of the guardsmen confined to the ward had been carried in the arms of their exhausted squadmates, or had limped in themselves. The staff, the rear echelon medical contingent of the 8th Corps, had barely set up that morning before the casualties began flooding in. They were wholly out of splints and were running short of plaster wraps and castor braces. And this was only one of the larger casualty wards. Polixis had parted ways with Squad Domitian at one of the forward triage stations near the base of Ridge 1's reverse slope. It was nothing more than a large open-sided tent with some jury-rigged tarps keeping the worst of the ash storm at bay. Medicaids and corpsmen were working in their respirators, and simply keeping wounds clean was nigh on an impossibility. Body bags were stacking up outside, many almost submerged in the drifting pall of ash that befouled everything in the wastes. Polixis had operated on Treasure with what little equipment he had to hand. When he'd arrived at the facility, a separate compartment outside the main ward featured hoses and decontamination units for those entering the sterile environment beyond. Polixis had begrudgingly permitted the servitors to remove the worst of the battle grime from his white plate, but a far more thorough job and the correct benedictions to the armor's venerable spirit would be required before it was free of the day's bitter legacy. As he stepped out through the sealant flaps and back into the wind and ash, he tried to quell the frustration that still simmered at the back of his mind. He had seen enough of the galaxy and its horrors to know just how badly mismatched individual servants of the Imperium were against their foes. The reality of mankind's struggle was something he knew he would never be comfortable obscuring. It was difficult to give hope when there was so little to go around. Ironically, it was his brother whose words could uplift. Polixis had seen him bring purpose and resolve to planetary governors and Underhive Savlar militia alike. To him, the words he spoke were not lies or manipulative half-truths. They were the fuel that kept the candle in the dark aflame, that stopped the light that gave humanity hope from guttering out. And Polixis couldn't deny that hope was their surest weapon, especially in times such as these. He turned to follow the eastern flank of the ridge towards the rally coordinates newly uploaded by Lieutenant Tyrannus. The Fulminata were to regroup at 8th Corps headquarters near the centre of the ridgeline. From there, they would oversee the preparation of the new defensive positions. At best, they would be largely completed by the time the Greenskins coordinated their inevitable offensive. At worst, the Fulminata would be the only one standing between the rampant Xenos and the complete collapse of Imperial forces west of Croton. Castor. Castor moved among the Imperial Guard like a vision of death. Men cringed away, gasped, even cried out as he passed by. The barked commands of officers and sergeants died on the wind as the spectre materialized from the ash and dust, the storm snatching at his vestments and the cowl that shrouded his nightmarish skull. The wounded were the most afraid, for some no doubt believed he had come for their souls. They clutched Aquila tokens and lucky charms and turned their eyes away, not daring to breathe through their respirators lest the rattling inhalation drew the glowering red gaze of the phantom. Castor strode the eastern slope of the ridgeline amidst those guard units newly arrived from Shebat. He spoke to some, and it was always the same message, a single word, follow. And follow they did, some out of fear, some out of awe, some because of the hope that, when their time came, the reaping spectre would remember them kindly. They followed, moving from the clogged trails being used by the other retreating columns towards shallower paths, almost lost amidst the ever-shifting wasteland. They went together, disparate men and women from the far corners of the galaxy, Voitikans and Kelestani, Faban vanquishers and Vostroyans, flame troopers from Pyre and marksmen from the snow forests of Lorik, first united under the Aquila and now again in the long shadow of the great grim figure who had led them through the wind and ash. Castor took them to the tribal rock that jutted close to the northern extent of Ridge 1. It was a gathering place for the nomadic scavenger peoples that inhabited the ash wastes, evidenced by the totemic remains heaped around the base of the stony protrusion. The dust-caked skulls of great ash fangs and greymores, and all manner of rusting detritus and trinkets, heaped the sides of the jagged outcrop. Amongst the litter, the Astra Militarum gathered, hundreds of respirator-clad faces staring upwards in silence. The chaplain climbed the flank of the ridge, and then turned along the top of the outcrop, his heavy boots grating slowly on stone. The wind was even stronger on top of the rock, making his robes and purity parchments flutter and snap. He drew back his cowl, revealing the full morbidity of his skull helm. Below, the human soldiers of the Imperium waited, more straggling in by the minute, drawn by the single, rasped command of the black-armored giant. The chaplain of the Fulminata raised Salve Imperata in one fist, slowly. Deactivated, the skull mace gleamed coldly in the grey light, its empty eye sockets seeming to glare down at the weary, ash-covered congregation. Castor held the weapon before them in silence, before he finally spoke.
"We have all failed," he said. "We have all fallen short of the devotion our Emperor requires of us."
The words were not delivered loudly or forcefully, only amplified enough by his helmet's vox unit to carry over the worst of the wind. It brought a murmur back to him, the half-voiced disbelief of those whose denial was finally coming undone.
"A day that started in glorious victory was seen out in the totality of abject defeat," he went on.
The murmurs rose.
"Perhaps your officers have told you otherwise. Perhaps they have sought out hope in what has befallen us. A tactical withdrawal and mass redeployment. That is to their credit, for it is their duty to maintain your resolve. But be under no illusions here, soldiers of the Emperor. We have failed him. Amid that defeat, who here has not lost a brother or squadmate? In among a city brought to ruination, who has not abandoned brethren trapped and crushed by the weight of Shebat's destruction?"
Someone shouted from the assembly, the words lost, but the anger clear.
"You are not alone,"
Castor said, still holding up his Crozius Arcanum.
"I am condemned with you, I and all my brothers. We too have failed. We too have been driven out by Xenos filth, cast into the wilderness by beasts that have no right to share this galaxy with us. Some of you will even have witnessed my brother's fall, brought low by the savagery of the greenskin menace. Yes, for we are not immortal on the field of battle. We die also, and the Ultramarines chapter has suffered a grievous blow amidst the ruins of Shebat."
There were more shouts, a swell of shock and outrage among the huddled congregation, rising like a tide over the fear the guardsmen felt towards the towering Primaris.
"This loss is no easy thing to take," Castor went on, voice amplified above their protestations. "Failures like these haunt the memory and breed doubt and fear among those not staunch in mind and soul. And yet, my brothers, and yet..."
The murmuring below trailed off as the guardsmen waited on the chaplain's words.
"Yet there is a strength in such a defeat, for the few who have the courage to find it. There is an awakening, new resolve, new understanding, a purpose that is clearer and firmer than what came before. Not all rally to it, not everyone stands again after they are struck down. But I do, and by your presence here, I know that you do, too."
This time, there was only silence. The chaplain's voice continued to rise, reverberating now through the ash storm, base and unyielding as iron.
"We were defeated yesterday, but we were not broken. We failed, but we have not been destroyed.
We are still standing, every one of us. And if we stand, we can fight. And if we can fight, we can win. Avenge our losses, wipe away the stain of our failure, and reclaim this world. For Wojtek and the Emperor!
Came a shout from someone close to the front of the assembly.
For Shibat and Ikara!
Added another. The voices in the crowd returned, rising no longer in dismay, but in pride and defiance.
The Xenos will come again,
Castor boomed.
But this time, when they do, we will be ready. This time, we will meet their savagery, and we will break them with Lasgun and with bayonet.
The crowd began to cheer. Castor continued.
Do not be dismayed by their violence or their numbers. Stand by your squadmates. Listen to the orders of your commanding officers. And above all, remember that you are soldiers of the God Emperor's Astra Militarum, the defenders of humanity, and the vanquishers of its darkest foes. No failure, no defeat. After today, we will know only victory. For the Emperor!
The final words were punctuated by the activation of Salve Imperata. Lightning surged up the mace and crackled about its skull tip, a sudden, searing affirmation that the chaplain's words were not mere oration. The cheering went on for long minutes, during which Castor privately narrated the 17th admonishment in his own head, a penitence canticle that reminded its reciter that their only worth was in their service to the Emperor and the chapter. The cheers of men had turned many of the Emperor's chosen from the path of righteousness before. Afterwards, he led the assembly in the singing of Imperata Gloriam, that old guard battle hymnal. In the meantime, fresh runners had arrived for the units Castor had gathered, bearing deployment and disposition dockets. The congregation started to disperse, moving now with less weariness and more purpose. Officers barked orders, and men rallied to platoon and company standards that streamed in the ash-heavy wind. Columns began to set off as their new orders were checked and confirmed. The pause had put steel and vigour into what had previously been a mass of tired, confused, and directionless men and women. Only one figure remained, formerly hidden amongst the crowds near the base of the rock, close to the old rubbish heaped up by the waste's tribespeople. Castor descended from his promontory and paced through the rusting detritus to where his brother stood and waited.
Why here? Polixis asked him. Because I can be seen, Castor replied, gesturing towards the rock, and because it pulls units away from the congestion on the main tracks. Moving them here means they can disperse more effectively, especially with the storm slowing everything down. Practicality, as well as fervor, Polixis said. You do the chapter honor, as ever. For a moment, neither Primaris spoke. Castor offered his arm. After the briefest hesitation, Polixis took it in the warrior's grip.
It's good to see you once again, brother, Castor said.
And to see you, Polixis said. I thank the Emperor that you left Shebat unharmed. I felt the hand of him on us both. Likewise with Squad Domitian. Brothers Trejo and Ennio will fight again?
They will, though Trejo not for some time. I shall visit him as soon as my duties allow. Knowing him, he will rail against anything that sees him removed from the front line, no matter how grievous the wounds. The Emperor knows we will need every battle brother soon enough.
There was silence between the two of them before Polixis spoke once more. And this time there was iron in his voice, as unyielding as Castor's when his words to the guard had reached their crescendo.
You sent the Reavers to see me safely out of Shabbat, didn't you? I did, Castor said, without any hint of hesitation. The Fulminatus suffered enough last night. I could not countenance the loss of its apothecary, as well as its captain, Ancient, and all those battle brothers who perished fighting to give the Astra Militarum time. Lieutenant Tyrannus approved the deployment of Severus and his brethren. He could have been elsewhere. He could have been securing the captain. Captain Demeter's orders were in no way uncertain. He wished to draw as many Xenos to himself for as long as possible. He did not intend to leave Shabbat. I hope you at least counseled him otherwise, Polixis said. Of course I did, Castor replied, fire now in his own voice. What would you have had me do? Disobey his orders? Go after him? Bring the rest of the Fulminata to his side? You know that what he did was perfectly within the bounds of the Codex, and more importantly, it saved lives. The defences on this ridge would not be enough without the evacuation of so many men from the city. He has given us a chance to stem the Xenos here when they come. You think these men who heard you today will stand when the Greenskins come again? You cannot be everywhere at once, Castor. What will your congregation say now that they disperse? Will enough men take heart from the stories that spread from your words? They will say they saw one of the God Emperor's chosen, Castor replied simply. And that doesn't bother you? Should it? Are we the Emperor's chosen, brother? I have certainly never found any particular divine spark to us, not when I have studied the physiology of our kind. There is no noble grace when I saw off limbs and suture flesh and try to restart twin hearts. We are brute meat, my brother, changed beyond recognition to fulfill a single purpose, the role of the warrior. We are no different from the vat-grown of Mars, or any machine that is crafted and optimized to fulfill a single, specific purpose. We are certainly no more divine than those men around us. In fact, perhaps we are less so. Do you not teach that mankind's glory is in the very nature of its humanity? As a Medicae, I would hesitate to call either of us human. Not anymore. You are angry, Castor said, his voice growing quiet. And that makes you churlish, brother. I will forget what you are saying here, for both our sakes. You think I am saying this only to annoy you, little brother? You think me so petty. I think you normally have a clearer mind than I, Polixis. I invite you to use that mind to question where these words are coming from. Turn your thoughts inwards and consider that it is this past day's pain and loss that is speaking, not you. Polixis drew in a deep breath rather than reply, and forced himself to consider the chaplain's counsel. A part of him already knew Castor was right. Another part wanted to refuse that realization. He wondered how often they had done this as children, arrayed in frustrated opposition to one another. The loss of the brother captain has affected me, Polixis admitted, speaking slowly now, as the anger drained from him little by little. The loss of all the battle brothers on this campaign has been a hard burden to bear. You know that none of them sit quietly with me. I have sought to better honor my role as this company's apothecary by distancing myself. But even after all this time, he trailed off. Castor picked up the words. You would not be a better apothecary if you did manage to distance yourself from those under your charge. That much I can assure you. Your very nature is what has led you to this role. It is a blessing and a curse. A curse because you feel each and every loss so acutely, but a blessing because you will never stop striving to help those in need. Your role is the hardest of anyone in the Brotherhood. We are all warriors. As you say, we have been bred for it. Yet you alone are expected to set aside the mindset of a trained killer to help and to heal. It is your protective nature that allows you to do that. Never feel the need to quash that. If you felt nothing for our fallen, I would be far more concerned.
Polixis nodded.
My thanks, brother. I had to say that. You are not alone, Castor replied. Do not forget that. We all feel the past day's losses. It is to be expected. Each of the fallen was an exemplar of the chapter. It is my duty to ensure that we all continue without surrendering to darker passions, bitterness, guilt, unchanneled rage.
I do not envy you your position, Brother Chaplain, Polixis said, offering his arm once more.
Nor I yours, Brother Apothecary,
Castor answered, taking him by the vambrace.
The Xenos will come again, and soon, I fear. When they do, go with care. I was speaking the truth when I said we cannot afford to lose you now as well.
I would demand the same of you, Polixis said, but I know I will find you wherever the fighting is hardest.
We all do the Emperor's will, one way or another,
Castor replied, and Polixis had known him long enough to be certain that there was a smile playing out behind the death grin of his skull helm.
I will see you again soon, brother.
Urgork. Urgork looked around at the vaults and statues that constituted the Humi's shrine thing. Cogcrusher had told him they called such a place a cathedral. Supposedly, it was the place where their big boss watched over them. There was no sign of him now, though, much to Urgork's chagrin. No Humis at all, in fact. They'd all run, like the weak, pink little runties they were. The war boss was standing with one boot on the side of the overturned stone slab that had formerly held pride of place in the echoing chamber. Beneath him, the mobs were already busy turning the structure into a place worthy of their war boss's presence. The statues were being hauled down and smashed, and the walls and pillars were being daubed with blood and dung. Nob Scabbit's lads were erecting a great orc skulldliff over the shattered windows at the rear of the chamber. Mork only knew where they'd scavenged it from. Most important of all were Urgork's own trophies. The stone slab was being refashioned by Cogcrusher and his tinkerers, the arching ceiling above resounding to the noise of chisel drills and welding hammers as they drove spikes and staves into the defiled white stone, fashioning a new throne for Urgork. Already, the great red-daubed squig hide of his personal banner had been draped above it, and his trophy rack had been laid out before it. The dead eyes and empty sockets of the war boss's vanquished challengers afforded a fine view of the greenskin occupation of the great building. Even more important were the latest additions to Urgork's spoils. The blue beakies had fought long and hard, whole mobs had been immolated by their blazing fires, and Urgork's own body still ached from the wounds he had suffered at the hands of their boss. If his own nob bodyguards hadn't outnumbered the beakies by so much, the fight may have even gone against the war boss. In the end, though, it was the big beaky lying dead, and not the other way around. The corpses of the defiant warriors, each as big and tough as the largest of Urgork's mob leaders, had been dragged to the warlord's new lair, their blue armour caked in dust and blood and defiled by markings carved in by their killers. Urgork was still deciding what to do with them, but for now they made a fine display at the foot of his new throne. He'd also ordered part of the cathedral's wall to be demolished to make room for the huge tank the Humis had been using. The machine bits that had allowed it to float seemed to have failed, but some makeshift runners fashioned from girders dragged from the city ruins, combined with the exertions of a trio of orc deaf dreads, had hauled the thing through the rubble all the way to Urgork's headquarters. The warlord had told Cogcrusher in no uncertain terms that he had to complete the new throne before he would be permitted to lay hands upon the captured war machine. He could practically feel the big mech's excitement buzzing in the air around him.
Boss!
Urgork grunted, tearing his eyes away from the stone slab and the welder-masked grots labouring around it. Stab's car had approached unnoticed, as he so often did. The commando's second-in-command, Grimtooth, was hovering close behind him, eyes darting between the warlord and his more immediate boss.
"You wanted me, boss,"
Stabskar went on. He was trying to act unconcerned, but Urgork could smell the fear on him, like the stink of grot piss.
"Stabskar!"
the war boss growled, straightening up to his full height so that he loomed over the two commandos.
"You done good securing this place. It's gonna be the headquarters till the last Yumi's outside the city has been crumped."
"That..."
Stabskar began, but Urgork carried on over him.
"I didn't tell you to find this place, though, did I, Stabber?"
Again, Stabskar tried to speak, and again Urgork continued without listening.
"What did I tell you to find, Stabber? Tell me what I sent you after."
Stabskar went silent, his eyes now on his spiked boots.
"The Beaky, boss,"
he said quietly.
"Which Beaky, Stabber?"
"The Beaky in white, boss. You wanted the Beaky in white bits."
"Exactly,"
Urgork said, smacking one hand down on Stabskar's shoulder, making the commando grunt.
"Exactly, Stabber! I got me plenty of Beakies in the end."
He paused to gesture expansively at the mound of corpses dumped at the base of his slowly forming throne.
"But what colour is they all, Stabber?"
Stabskar hesitated, choking on his words as he tried to avoid the obvious.
"Oh, look,"
Urgork said, taking his hand off the orc's shoulder and bending to drag one claw through the dust and blood caking one of the Humi's armour, leaving a clear trail. He turned sharply back and bellowed in Stabskar's face, a wad of phlegm splattering the stunned greenskin.
"They's blue, Stabber! All of them. No whitens."
"We looked, boss,"
Stabskar managed, cringing back.
"And you found him, didn't you?"
Urgork demanded. Stabskar had no reply, and the bigger orc went on.
"You found him, and you let him leg it. Yeah, I was told all about that."
Stabskar turned towards Grimtooth, still lurking behind him, sudden anger replacing the fear in his eyes. Urgork snatched him again before he could fully round on his subordinate and dragged him in close.
"I gave you one job," the war boss snarled. "So now you gets the reward coming to you. Doc!"
The final word echoed through the vaulted chamber. It was followed by a scampering noise as Grok emerged from behind the apse, hauling his squig satchel full of saw blades and needles.
"My injection, Doc!"
Urgork demanded, holding out one hand while keeping Stabskar clamped in the other. The commando began to struggle, but it was too late. Without pause, Urgork snatched the heavy syringe Grok offered and plunged it into Stabskar's thick neck. Grinning darkly, the war boss jabbed the plunger down. The effect was instantaneous. Stabskar gasped and choked, both hands gripping Urgork's arm as his eyes began to bulge. A mewling noise escaped his throat, and foam started bubbling from between his tusks. Urgork released him and pushed him towards the steps of the raised stone slab. The commando fell to his knees on the edge, hands now clutching his throat, and released a great heaving explosion of vomit. It hit the steps and the flagstones below, making the nearest orcs beneath push and shove one another to avoid it. The bile darkened rapidly, and the lumps floating in it thickened. Stabskar's eyes were wide with agony as he continued to throw up parts of his liquidating internal organs,
blood and mulched stomach, following pieces of lung and his intestines. He voided his bowels as well, and the flood from his maw lessened abruptly as his throat gave way beneath the acidic flow, disintegrating and drenching his chest. Finally, the greenskin collapsed forwards, rolling down the stairs, covering himself in his own dissolved innards. He came to a stop at the bottom, face down in the steaming, slowly spreading slurry, twitching as the syringe's contents ate away the last of his guts. Silence reigned. Every greenskin in the chamber had stopped and was staring at Stabskar's corpse as it slowly became still.
"Can't take his medicine,"
Urgork grunted, smacking the empty syringe back into Grok's satchel and shoving the pain boy away. The warboss glared at the mass of orcs below and kicked a boot against the corpse of one of the blue beakies, the clatter making everyone jump.
"Who said you could stop working, you gits?"
he demanded. The orcs hurried to look busy again as Urgork turned towards Grimtooth. The commando had been trying to slink away unnoticed, but froze under Urgork's gaze.
"Got somewhere better to be?" the war boss demanded.
No, boss,
Grimtooth replied, shaking his head vigorously. Urgork grunted and moved down the steps to the side of Stabskar's corpse, boots splashing in the foul, steaming patina that had drenched the flagstones. He yanked the orc's soiled camo cape from the body and tossed it to Grimtooth, who caught it with a grimace. He then gripped Stabskar's remains by the scruff of the neck and dragged him back up the stairs, through his own fluids, until he was slumped over the stone slab. Urgork waved Cogcrusher and his grot workers away with one hand, drawing one of his skinning blades with the other.
"This is a good way to break the new boss chair in, ain't it?"
he asked Grimtooth. The commando simply nodded, dripping cape in one fist, staring as the war boss plunged the blade into the flank of his erstwhile boss and began slowly peeling back a layer of tough green hide.
"You is the boss of Stabber's mob now, Grim,"
Urgork went on, working his blade slowly and methodically just beneath Stabskar's flesh, stripping it away little by little as he flensed the torso back to oozing, part-liquefied muscle.
"Yes, boss,"
Grimtooth said quietly, watching with horrified fascination as the war boss worked.
"Same orders,"
Urgork said, not taking his eye from his blade's progress.
"Find the white beaky. Bring him here, alive. Reckon you can do that?"
"Yes, boss,"
Grimtooth said again.
"Send out Grots,"
Urgork said, gripping a section of flesh with his free hand and dragging it back. Blood and jellied matter was drenching the white stone slab beneath Stabskar's now ragged corpse, running down to pool beneath the mound of beaky dead piled before it.
"Use your sneaky lads. You know 'em. I'm sending Zograk to attack the Humies outside the city tonight. Go in with his lads and get me that zogging beaky. If you don't, don't come back."
"Gotcha, boss,"
Grimtooth said, still staring at the gruesome work. Urgork half turned the corpse over, continuing to slide his long blade with a short, firm skimming motion. The war boss paused and looked up, glaring at the remaining commando.
"You still here?"
Grimtooth turned and left hastily, boots splashing in Stabskar's effluvium, as the great skaldlift being erected by Skabit's mob finally thumped into place. Grimtooth. Outside the war boss's new lair, more green skins were gathering, filling the ruined square with raucous tribal chants and the growling, revving engines of the war trucks that now choked what remained of the adjacent streets. The rest of the commandos were crouched on the steps close to the big, spiky building's broken-down entrance, and they gathered around Grimtooth as he stepped out.
"Where's the boss?"
Krulkill asked.
Dead,
Grimtooth said, baring his tusks.
He failed the big boss too many times. I'm in charge of this here mob now. Big boss's orders. Any git what complains can take it up with him, right once he's done making a new banner from Stabber's hide.
There was no response from the assembled greenskins. Grimtooth looked at each in turn, but none met his gaze. Even without knowing the exact details of what had happened to Stabskar, the threat of Urgork's displeasure was enough. He wrung the stinking bile from the former boss's ragged cape, and with all due ceremony, draped it over his own shoulders before speaking again.
Same job as before. He wants the white beaky boy. This time, we're gonna get it done. I ain't ending up like Stabber. How we finding him, though, boss?
Urgin asked.
All the Humies are gone. He could be anywhere by now. Humies is just to the east,
Grimtooth said.
We'll send out the Grots. Dorkin and Krulkill, you make sure they do it right. All these lads are headed for a scrap tonight.
He gestured at the mobs filling the square. More were still pouring in, drawn to the new seat of power now established by their war boss. They'd won a great victory the day before, and now they were hungry for more. Grimtooth could feel the power of the war suffusing the very air around him, making it practically crackle with energy. The sound and fury of so many good lads gathered together made the very stones of the ruined city vibrate. The urge to get stuck in was almost overwhelming. They were commandos, though. They played it cleverer than the footsloggers.
"We'll go in under the cover of the assault," he went on. "Probably be dark, too, so that'll help. Once the Grots have him fixed, we're in and out sharpish. Big Boss wants to get alive, so no mistakes. Always all squig food. Stick close and keep a good eye out. Got it?"
The rest of the mob grunted their affirmation. Grimtooth turned his gaze back to the mobs below, as the chanting and bellowing reached a bestial, heart-pounding crescendo. Despite himself, he realized he was grinning. One way or another, they were headed for a right good scrap.